Hello and welcome to the Geneva Health Files podcast. I am Preeti Patnaik, the founding editor of Geneva Health Files, a weekly investigative newsletter that explores power and politics in global health. Welcome to a new episode. Today we bring you a comprehensive interview with Fatima Hassan, a South African activist and lawyer whose efforts have forced greater transparency on how contracts were negotiated and how vaccines were procured during COVID-19. Hassan is recognized for her work on health and human rights. She leads Health Justice Initiative, a Cape Town-based NGO. During a visit to Geneva in September 2023, Hassan took the time for us to talk at length about her motivation and her efforts on pushing for transparency in vaccine contract negotiations in South Africa. We are deeply grateful to her for explaining the many twists and turns in the tenacious advocacy efforts that have established a benchmark on how transparency is fought for and won. Thanks so much for joining us today, Fatima, and welcome to Geneva.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to see you in person finally. So we would really like to understand, how did this fight for transparency begin in South Africa? What made you bring a case against the government of South Africa for greater transparency in the COVID-19 contracts? And maybe you can also talk about the role of NGOs in sort of pushing the boundaries of this discussion post-pandemic.
Thanks. So firstly, I mean, the case in South Africa builds on the excellent work that other civil society activists and NGOs have done in South Africa on using access to information laws in South Africa that are considered quite progressive and quite positive in respect of more open procurement. So I live in a country with very high levels of inequality, where our health bill is quite high, but where we don't necessarily see the right outcomes for the amount of money we're spending. And so the case comes within a context of where South Africa was asked to put billions and billions of public money on the table. So we estimate anywhere between 11 to 14 billion rand at a time when not just South Africa, but everywhere else in the world, we faced multiple lockdowns, where the social relief support systems were not adequate for the most marginalized and the most affected by the COVID pandemic, and in our case, mainly Black African men and women in particular. So at a time when the world had basically entered this global pandemic, and we were promised a lot of solidarity, which didn't really materialize, we in Africa were waiting and waiting and waiting for vaccine supplies. And then we were told two things. One, that COVAX would be set up to support people like me and others in South Africa and elsewhere in Africa and Latin America, and that we shouldn't worry. The market will work. The system has our back. We don't need to enter bilaterals because COVAX will make sure that there's equity in allocation for low and middle income countries. And that never happened. And sorry to say, but like many other commentators have said, I think COVAX has been a spectacular failure, and I really hope there isn't a repeat of a COVAX-type mechanism in the next pandemic. Because if that is the case, then we will all wait for a very long time for the market to try and, you know, remedy itself and to try and prioritize our lives in the global south. But at the same time that we were being told that there would be solidarity in the sharing of knowledge and resources, that we would prioritize all healthcare workers first around the world, and obviously we know what happened, you know, we're talking about deaths in the region of 20 million people within the space of 3 years, directly and indirectly caused by COVID. Our government had to scramble, and we now know, and they've now conceded 3 years later, actually bullied into signing very onerous agreements in order to access very scarce supplies of vaccines. And we can talk, you know, about the systemic factors that give rise to scarcity in the time of a pandemic. But the bottom line is they were able to secure supplies from four suppliers three of which are pharmaceutical companies, and one is a supposed not-for-profit initiative, which is COVAX, which is administered by Gavi. So those are the four suppliers. And we were concerned, and we raised the alarm bells from 2020 already, that if the response to this pandemic is no sharing of knowledge and supplies and resources, as encapsulated also in what's called the TRIPS waiver proposal, that we would have a situation of scarcity, man-made scarcity, that we would have a situation of priority customers, which we saw the Global North was the priority customer, and we now have the contracts to confirm that they were also placed, you know, way ahead in the queue for supplies that enabled even the diversion of supplies of vaccines, filled and finished in South Africa for European customers first while we were waiting for vaccines. So the better part of 2021, we're waiting for vaccines. We know that our country has entered into these contracts because our government has said to us, wait, the vaccines are coming. We've signed these contracts. We're waiting for supplies. And we basically waited and waited and waited for the better part of 2021. We were subjected to a drip feed of supplies, a few, you know, whimsical donations here and there, but largely a global supply chain that couldn't keep up with demand. And again, that could have been very different. It wasn't. And a lot of us, including our parents, our grandparents, you know, people with comorbidities in my country, people living with HIV and TB infection who really needed these vaccines, alongside facing multiple travel bans, racist travel bans, I might add, alongside being really advanced in identifying new variants or like significant sophisticated genomic surveillance system in South Africa, alongside doing at least 5 clinical trials for vaccines, research contributing to global scientific knowledge, we were told that your time will come and you must wait. So this is what we mean by a drip feed of supplies. And we tracked supplies as the Health Justice Initiative and noticed that for the first 3 quarters we were of 2021, at least, we were getting very negligible amounts of supplies, which explains why South Africa could not have a national mass vaccination program. We had to do it per age. The entire program had to pivot from what initially they thought would be a Johnson & Johnson program to a Pfizer two-dose program because we were waiting for Johnson & Johnson supplies and they were not coming. Later, we found out that they were actually, you know, 30 million at least was diverted to Europe and wasn't for our benefit. And until the New York Times broke that story, you know, Johnson & Johnson gave no undertaking that they would pause the exports to Europe. And those vaccines were meant to benefit Africa. So when we were told by government officials in our parliament, because we still have, you know, a functioning democracy to a large extent, where the minister is accountable to parliament and he has to answer questions, where there was a lot of public pressure around where are our vaccines and our government was exclusively blamed for those delays, they indicated, like many other countries in Latin America, that the demands by these companies were so one-sided and onerous that the delays we were experiencing were also to satisfy these pharmaceutical companies. And so what we saw was a rapid establishment, for example, of a vaccine injury fund. And the reason we were told as the public that we only had 72 hours to make a submission on a really important mechanism, which had to be fully underwritten by the South African government, that would give full indemnification to, in particular, Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. What we learned was that unless the scheme was set up and the fund was set up and underwritten by the South African government, that not a single vaccine dose would be delivered outside of a clinical trial to South Africa. So that was just the beginning of the indications that the power was so distorted and that our government and all of us, by virtue of that, were in a hostage situation. If you want the vaccines, then these are the terms and conditions. You're going to have to agree to it. And it's a secret. It's subject to a non-disclosure agreement, so you can't share any of this with the public. We've now remedied that, and we can talk about that shortly. And on top of that, we will determine when you will get your vaccines, at what price, under what terms and conditions, whether you as a sovereign government have any power to impose export restrictions, to impose any other limits. And at the same time, we won't support your call as the South African government for a TRIPS waiver. So we will not share knowledge, we will not share the contract terms and conditions, and we will not share supplies. And we will prevent others from being able to assist you because we will place bars and prohibitions on when donations can happen, how donations can happen, how excess stock can be moved around the world. So really a hostage situation, excessive power by the industry. And that is what made us concerned. Because it's a different situation if 14 billion was put on the table by a wealthy philanthropist. That is not how we bought vaccines in South Africa. It was our money, the public's money. And in South Africa, under democracy, and if you believe in the rule of law, then you can't be selective in following the rule of law. Procurement has to be open, it has to be transparent, it has to be accountable, especially when you're using public resources. And in the middle of a pandemic, when you're trying to create trust in a national vaccination program. So the more secrecy you have, the more distrust there is in the vaccine program, and you allow anti-vaccine movements to grow. So secrecy is not a useful public health safeguard. And that is the reason we as the health justice were concerned that if you create a precedent for secrecy and for non-disclosure agreements in the procurement of vaccines in this pandemic, then you create a precedent for secret procurement in any other epidemic or pandemic. And we as a country are moving towards national health insurance, where the state will be the sole procurer of all medical goods. This is not the precedent we wanted. This would be dangerous. Secrecy has no place in a pandemic. It has to be, there has to be transparency, particularly when you're also dealing with a not-for-profit initiative like Gavi and COVAX. I mean, there's just really no moral, legal, justifiable ground for this level of secrecy. You need to bring the light in. So the amount of public resources, the fact that you're trying to foster trust, you want greater uptake into the vaccine program, means you should actually err on the side of greater disclosure. And what we were told by our government was that they could tell us nothing. Everything was a secret because the companies insisted on non-disclosure agreements.
Right.
Why?
Great. Thanks for laying out the context for us. And I think the situations that you describe in South Africa holds true across many countries in the world. Just taking a step back, if you could tell our listeners about the court shared the documents with Health Justice Initiative in August 2023. When did you actually file the case? And what did you find, of course? What did these contracts reveal? Just briefly, if you could discuss. How difficult was it as an NGO to actually push for this?
So the Health Justice Initiative started this case in early 2022. We are fortunate that our country has a set of access to information laws that allows any interested party, including a non-governmental organization, to seek access to information on contracts or records that are not classified, you know, broadly as a state secret or not subject to a cabinet privilege. So that would mean an executive privilege, to be able to seek access to those records through a process. And we filed the access to information request. We were told by the Director General of the Department of Health that they would notify the third parties involved, because this involved third parties. It wasn't just records of our government. And our law allows us to ask our government for records relating to contracts or negotiations it entered into with the third party. In this case, it was pharmaceutical companies and Gavi. We were told that they would be approached to see what their views were so that government could make a decision. There was no decision. We lodged an internal appeal, and that was also refused. And our law provides that if an appeal is refused, you can approach the courts for relief. And that's when we filed our papers with the Gauteng High Court. That was towards 2022. By mid-2023, we were given a court hearing date. We argued the case, and really grateful for an excellent judgment by Miller J. That came out a few weeks later. And the court basically ordered that it was in the public interest for people in South Africa to be able to view all of the COVID vaccine procurement contracts with all relevant parties, including the companies that we eventually got supplies from, and that we also had a right to see all the negotiation outcomes and minutes and you know, the processes that underpinned a series of negotiations, including with other companies such as Moderna, for example. Because as you'll know, in South Africa, we managed to get supplies from the four entities we've talked about before: Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Serum Institute of India, and COVAX Gavi. And the court also, and I think this is what's critical for transparency, found that there was no grounds to justify the non-disclosure or redacted disclosure. And so the court ordered that the unredacted versions of all of these documents and contracts must be made available to the Health Justice Initiative within 10 days of the judgment. And fortunately, the Minister of Health in South Africa, and I think kudos to him for taking this decision, decided not to appeal the judgment. The other important aspect of the court judgment was that the court found that the application by the Health Justice Initiative and the entire set of proceedings was not defective because we did not cite the pharmaceutical companies. It found that the duty and the onus was on our government to have consulted the companies and the other suppliers and include them, because we made reasonable efforts to find out what the legal service address of all of the relevant entities and suppliers were, but all of our efforts to try and establish that information were rebuffed, in the words of the court. So you will remember that we weren't only told that the terms and conditions were secret, we were also told by government and all of these different officers that the contracting parties' details were secret and that they couldn't tell us who they were legally. So we couldn't serve legal papers on Pfizer or J&J or COVAX and Gavi or Serum or Moderna or any of the other companies because they refused to provide that information with us. And so that argument by the South African Department of Health that the case should not proceed because the companies were not before the court, therefore also failed. But be that as it may, the government of South Africa, to its credit, decided not to appeal the decision, asked for an extension to provide the documents, and the Health Justice Initiative granted an extension for the other records, what we call the negotiation minutes and processes and records and outcomes. That will be provided to us at the end of September 2023. But the four contracts that South Africa entered into were handed to us in an unredacted form within the 10 court days. That has now been made public by the Health Justice Initiative and a group of other civil society organizations, academics, researchers, what we call the multi-stakeholder group. And the contracts are accompanied by our analysis of all of these different contracts. We'll supplement that analysis once we get the balance of the documents. What we found in, you know, the high-level summary of what we found in the four contracts. And if you read the analysis, you will note some of the disclaimers because we believe that there are one or two annexures that were not provided to us, which we are still trying to obtain. Mm-hmm. But from the documents given to us, what we found is huge variations and disparities in the price that were charged for vaccines for South Africa compared to other countries. In some cases, we were actually charged more than countries in the global north, according to the contracts we've signed. Now, if there's been a change in that, we do not have the amendment. We don't know the final statement of account. We don't know what refunds we've received. And we don't know for how long the special pricing dispensations may have lasted. More egregious than the pricing disparities were the terms and conditions relating to the power of the industry. And in it, all four, there were no guarantees of volumes, there were no guarantees of price. There was no guarantees of exact timing of deliveries, which makes it really difficult to plan a national vaccine program to vaccinate the entire country if you can't have any certainty of when the supplies would come in. On top of that, there were provisions which basically said that the companies would have full indemnification against any and all forms of liability for the use of the vaccine, but also that there were no penalty provisions for non-delivery of supplies or late delivery of supplies. So if you decided to buy 30 million vaccines and they were delivered 18 or 24 months later when there were already new variants, you would be liable for that. The terms and conditions around the advance payment were particularly worrying. And, you know, if this is going to be replicated in the next pandemic, it just constitutes a lot of wastage of very scarce public resources. And broadly, those advance payment terms and conditions were that in some cases, even if there was non-delivery or if a country decided they didn't want the balance of vaccine supplies because they're able to source it from other suppliers because there's multiple bilateral agreements at the same time, then you would be responsible, like in the case of Pfizer, for 50% of the advance payment. So, you know, you're basically guaranteeing a lot of money for these companies without necessarily seeing a significant return. I think one of the most scandalous provisions that we found was in the Johnson & Johnson contract. And this was part of a breaking story that the New York Times did in late 2021. And the provision is as follows. It precludes the South African government from imposing any export restrictions on any vaccines filled and finished by Aspen, a different company, a private company for Johnson & Johnson, during the time when we needed vaccines the most. So the net result of that is in 2021, while South Africans were waiting for vaccines and we're facing devastating wave after wave of infection, we're waiting for J&J supplies and we're told that they will come one day. And then we find out that this particular term in this contract with our government was inserted basically to benefit J&J and Aspen in its own separate contract. And at least 30 million vaccines that were filled and finished by Aspen in the Eastern Cape in South Africa left our shores for the benefit of Europeans in Europe. They were the priority customer. And now, this was at a time when we had also learned that the United Kingdom, for example, was a priority customer for the global set of supplies that were coming from AstraZeneca and the Serum Institute of India. So it wasn't just that these global North countries weren't supporting the proposal on the TRIPS waiver or greater sharing of knowledge and doing everything in their power to delay that. It wasn't just that they were over-ordering supplies from multiple manufacturers or not necessarily providing the right commitment and support and funding to COVAX, but they were also inserting themselves as priority customers, like as if you on a, you know, on a first-class flight or a... And all of us were sitting in economy waiting very patiently and very long while a lot of people were getting sick and dying for supplies. The Pfizer contract, for example, also includes a term, which is quite ironic, that they basically would be given protection against any IP infringement on their part.
Yes.
While Pfizer was blocking the TRIPS waiver. So they were seeking a waiver for themselves, but not supporting the call for a global TRIPS waiver. And then there's other terms and conditions, which if you read the contracts, you'll find quite alarming. But I think that's sort of the gist of some of the most problematic provisions. And then if you turn to COVAX and Gavi, I mean, I think what was quite surprising in the agreement that was given to us was that we couldn't find in that particular agreement a confidentiality clause. So we are unsure why Gavi and COVAX held on to this contract as a secret for so long. They should have just made it open when it was signed. But they also didn't include the minimum price for the vaccine. They talk about a maximum price. There's still price uncertainty on the COVAX-Gavi contract. In 2021, by the end of 2021, they only delivered 1.3 million of Pfizer's vaccines. And we're concerned that they may have actually charged us more than what we actually paid to Pfizer directly, which is a real concern. There's also a COVAX-Gavi premium, which is added to the price. That's also uncertain. So there's a series of unanswered questions that arise from these contracts and these terms and conditions beyond just the indemnification and confidentiality provisions. And one has to really ask, if you're interested in global health, whether you're working at the World Health Organization, whether you're working for any of the different foundations or in civil society, why the secrecy? Why the lack of transparency? And can we get an investigation into how this actually happened? Because if we're going to have a pandemic accord without any transparency norms and standards, then I really worry that this is what will happen in the next contract. Because this took 2.5 years for these contracts to be disclosed. We are a small NGO with limited funding that managed to get legal support on a pro bono basis. And luckily, we didn't have to take it to the highest court in the land, which would have been even more expensive. But there's something fundamentally wrong if the only way you can get a procurement contract signed during a global emergency, health emergency, to be open is through legal action by an NGO in every single country. I mean, are we going to have 180 lawsuits to be able to get transparency? I think that tells you that there's something fundamentally wrong. And I think the worst culprit here has to be the not-for-profit initiative. I mean, it should be setting itself apart from the industry and the pharmaceutical companies. Its board should really look into the way in which it's contracting, because it's not, you know, Gavi is not just procuring vaccines for COVID, it's procuring vaccines for a whole range of other diseases on the grounds that it's actually trying to help low middle income countries. But I have to say that this kind of secrecy helps no one. And I don't think that these initiatives are doing us any favor by protecting the industry with so much secrecy.
Thanks so much. I think the timing of these revelations cannot be really overstated. As you know, in September 2023, WHO member states are at the cusp of, you know, beginning serious negotiations on the pandemic accord and amendments to the IHR. And issues such as transparency, terms and conditions attached to public funding, and all of these issues on procurement, all of this will be negotiated, and one wonders whether some of the learnings from South Africa will be sort of taken into cognizance by negotiators here in Geneva. So Fatima, congratulations to you and your team for really bringing to light a lot of these secret dealings, as it were. And as you're aware, all over the world, I can definitely add here in Switzerland and at the European Union level as well, a lot of journalists and activists are actually fighting to get more transparencies, particularly around the COVID-19 contracts. So what are the lessons and advice that you have for activists in other parts of the world? Do you think there will be sort of a domino effect in terms of potential implications for transparency even outside of South Africa?
Thanks. So I think, you know, there's two parts to that question. The first is that the case has obviously had an impact. And I was just at the UN meetings last week for all of the different General Assembly discussions around, you know, declarations on pandemic preparedness, around TB, around universal health coverage. And I think that it's presented a reckoning moment of, do we want to go forward in global health and even in the next pandemic or epidemic? And by all accounts, we could have another pandemic in the next 25 years. So this is not a hypothetical situation. And the reckoning is, how do we balance these demands for secrecy and what we call bullying? That's what the contract showed. That's the South African government was bullied. The South African government officials, since the disclosure of the contracts, have conceded in multiple public interviews that they were bullied and that it was not an ideal situation, and they were told, take it or leave it. If you don't agree to these terms and conditions, the companies would not supply your content, and they would walk away. So the reckoning has to be, how do we regulate private power?
Yeah.
Right. And so that is the lesson. What are we going to do in relation to the pandemic treaty, which is now the deliberations have moved to Geneva? And there's a certain irony to Geneva somehow being the focal point for all of our health going forward, because it is not representative of the reality of most people in the global south. And the fact that the WTO, the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, Gavi, COVAX, the Global Fund, the Madsen Patent Pool are all based here is a fundamental concern for me and a fundamental problem, because it is totally removed from any kind of reality of what's really going on, of where the patients are and where the epidemics are and where the pandemics are the most acutely felt. So how are we going to deal with this in relation to the pandemic treaty? How are we going to regulate private power? And I think the contracts are just one symptom of how that power operates. We can do a whole analysis of what happened in the last 3 years at the World Trade Organization in terms of the deliberations and negotiations, where they are still in 2023 talking about how to deal with the request of a waiver on therapeutics and diagnostics for COVID. This is 2023.
That's what brings Fatima to Geneva in September 2023, by the way.
Yeah. So 14 to 20 million deaths later, world leaders are still talking about this. That means it's a fundamental problem. So what does it mean for other civil society groups and for the work we're trying to do around transparency in procurement, particularly in a time of a pandemic, that there is a possibility to challenge that private power? It may take some time, but if you use the law quite creatively, and what we did in South Africa was you have to sue your own government as a proxy for... Yeah. Taking on private power, because our laws allow us to do that because of the way in which our procurement laws are set up. Now, in other countries, it may be different, but the experience of activists in Colombia has also been one of success and quite fascinating, where they too took on their government for the public disclosure of contracts. And while they were appealing, the contracts were erroneously sent in an unredacted form to a journalist who then made it open. But the consequences for their journalists were severe.
Yeah.
In South Africa, it's quite different because we were not harassed and we were not, our lives were not at risk because we saw the disclosure of the contracts. Very different depending on which context you're in. Experience of activists in the UK and the US is that they've only been able to receive so far redacted versions of contracts. So they don't as yet have the full unredacted versions and stories. In the EU, there's a lot of efforts from groups on the left and groups on the right who are trying to access...
For different reasons,
trying to access, in particular, the contract with Pfizer. And again, I have to emphasize that the more secrecy you have, the more distrust you fuel in a growing anti-vaccine climate in the world, an anti-health climate, an anti-WHO climate. And so it really... is, I think, imperative that world leaders deal with this issue of transparency, because the more secrecy you have, the more it's going to harm a global health agenda. The experience recently in the last few weeks of Kenyan activists following from the South African cases, they too are now using the laws available to them to try and get disclosure of the contracts with the South African case as a precedent for their judiciary to show two things. One, even if you disclose the contract, the world is not going to come to an end, which is what the industry always tells us. And secondly, it's very difficult for a pharmaceutical company to actually exit your company because you've disclosed a procurement contract. If they do that, then I think that is something that would be so selfish and so unreasonable that their shareholders as well as their boards would, you know, would have to have a major intervention. So I think there's a lot of threats that fly around when you want access to information. We'll disinvest from your country, we'll exit your country. And our counter is, but don't you believe in the rule of law? So when the rule of law is to the benefit of the industry on patent protection or the World Trade Organization rules, then those companies want to entrench those rules and seek protection from those rules. But when the rules of a country compel you to public disclosure, you know, then you have to comply.
Yeah.
Because remember, the bottom line is that our money contributed to their profits in the last 3 years, and the profits were immense. I mean, the People's Vaccine Campaign have talked about 40 billionaires in the space of 2 years. For Pfizer in particular, you know, the vaccine as well as the new versions for bivalent vaccines have given it immense profits. Billions and billions of dollars. So we're not talking negligible amounts. And I think we have to grapple with the power imbalance that we're dealing with. But I think that governments in the global south have to stand up. And if the repercussions for South Africa are what we've experienced in the last 3 weeks, which is not harmful, the disclosure has not been harmful, then I think it gives impetus to activists and governments elsewhere for the disclosure. And numerous public figures and Nobel laureates and others, including world leaders, have spoken about what these contracts entail and how one-sided they were and how bullying they are, you know, at last week's meetings in New York. So I think there is a greater appreciation for what activists had talked about for the last 3 years, the pernicious bullying of the industry. I think the evidence is now there for everybody to see, and hopefully it will inspire and catalyze a lot more activists to use their different access to information laws in their countries to its maximum potential to try and get disclosure of all the contracts. I mean, I think, you know, at best what we should be having is an undertaking by the boards of all of these pharmaceutical companies that in the next week, all the COVID vaccine procurement contracts for every single country in the world will be open. Transparency International latest data is that less than 10% of all the contracts signed in this pandemic are actually open.
Right.
That is a shocking statistic.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be remedied.
I certainly do think that there is an opportunity for WHO member states to at least partly address some of the power dynamics that you are talking about. Just to wrap up, what's the next frontier for activists like you, specifically in the access to medicine space? Is it pricing? Is it antitrust? And how would you sort of build on the momentum based on your recent success?
Yeah. So I think it builds on, you know, the work of the access movement for the last 25 years and why transparency is so crucial. And it's not just transparency in contracting. It's also transparency in price, like you've mentioned, and transparency in the patenting strategies of these companies. So just, you know, following the scathing analysis of these one-sided contracts where our government admitted that they were bullied, we found evidence that they were bullied. The Competition Commission in South Africa, which is the equivalent of an antitrust body elsewhere, announced a formal investigation into Johnson & Johnson for its pricing, historical pricing of bedaquiline, a very key TB drug, but also for the first time in an unprecedented, you know, a move and an announcement, is looking at the evergreening conduct of Johnson & Johnson for filing a secondary patent, which gives it, you know, even greater exclusivity on bedaquiline, and looking at that conduct as exclusionary conduct, which is sort of a term used in South Africa's competition laws. And I think that's significant because finally there is an understanding and deeper appreciation that if we're going to tackle the issue of transparency, you have to approach it from multiple entry points, and that there is a role for civil society. But the most sure and certain way to ensure regulatory transparency and legal certainty is for governments in the Global South to act and for its regulatory bodies to act. So, you know, we really are very supportive of this investigation because it shines a spotlight on Johnson & Johnson, you know, which was one of the more egregious contracts in the vaccine procurement saga, around other drugs. And I think that's the important part, is that no company is God, no CEO is immune from scrutiny, and that, you know, companies like Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Moderna need to be scrutinized for all of their practices and conducts. And I think that's what's important, is that transparency is becoming a more important part of our vocabulary in dealing with the management of pandemics and epidemics.
Thank you so much, Fatima. Maybe you want to share what brings you to Geneva?
So,
an unfinished agenda.
Yes. I mean, for a long time as activists from our HIV days, we've been talking about, again, I think the very pernicious role that the World Trade Organization plays in whether you or me get access to a vaccine or a medicine in a timely manner and in an affordable manner. Because unfortunately, it's so caught up in a system of trade rules and intellectual property rules. And I think the saddest part of the work that we do is that medicines are still commodified and treated like a handbag or a luxury phone. And it's because of the World Trade Organization and because of what we call the TRIPS Agreement and because of the very, you know, the difficulties inherent in using what we call the Doha Declaration. So, I mean, I come from a country that has had a massive HIV crisis. We're now the epicenter of the HIV and TB pandemic. We had a devastating COVID pandemic, and our government has never once been able to issue a compulsory license on a pharmaceutical product.
Right.
And when we asked the world in June 2020 already for a temporary waiver on intellectual property rules just for this COVID pandemic, we were told that we should use compulsory licenses. We were told that COVAX will sort out equity. We were told that the companies have our back. We were told we didn't need a waiver, that it would stifle innovation, that it would do X, Y, Z. And unfortunately, all those delays cost lives because we didn't have a decision up until a few months ago. And, you know, at best, we've called it a very bad deal. It's a very bad decision, not really usable for vaccines only. And so the meetings this week in Geneva are where, for the first time, external stakeholders, including NGOs, and our group is just one of them, We've been invited by the co-chairs of the TRIPS Council to make submissions on the still continuing deliberations in 2023 on whether there should be a temporary waiver related to therapeutics and diagnostics. And remember, most of us come from contexts in the Global South where all the money was used for vaccines, and the contracts that we've disclosed have showed in some cases, you know, at a really high price, in some cases at inflated prices, yeah, compared to Global North countries, that there is no money left to buy expensive therapeutics, and that diagnostics is just, you know, that capacity has become impossible unless a philanthropist decides that they want to donate some testing kits. So a really important conversation, but we've been asked to make input, and I hope that we'll be able to, you know, have those conversations about what use is the WTO if it takes 2.5 years to come up with one decision on vaccines, and it's, you know, it's now in its third year of deliberations on what to do with diagnostics and therapeutics, mainly, again, because of the US government's position on this and the EU's position on this and their resistance, and a lot of lobbying by the pharmaceutical industry to not pass a waiver.
All right. Thank you so much, Fatima, for joining us and for your inspiring work.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all your work. And if you all haven't subscribed to Geneva Health Files, please do.
Thank you so much.
So that was Fatima Hassan illustrating the power of sustained advocacy and its impact on global health policy making. This expansive and timely interview will hopefully illustrate the consistency of efforts by civil society actors fighting for accountability in global health and the sheer power imbalances that underpin this ecosystem. And another reason why this interview is important is because how countries are now negotiating rules on confidentiality, access to information, prices, and overall transparency in the governance of health emergencies by way of a new pandemic agreement. So although secrecy imperiled the access to medical products and affected lives during COVID-19, we do not know yet whether countries will actually learn from this experience and commit to binding obligations to prevent confidentiality clauses in contracts in a new pandemic agreement. Keep up with our work as we track these negotiations. For more interviews like this and for deeper analysis on global health, check out our investigative newsletter, Geneva Health Files, on Substack by visiting genevahealthfiles.substack.com. Or follow us on social media at FilesGeneva on Twitter. Thank you for the listen. Until next time, goodbye.